president of the country, so any contact was going to have to wait. Mirek finished his prayer, crossed himself again, then whispered, "Come with me." They left the chapel and headed back into the basilica, bypassing its opulence and finding a series of rear passages that led to a room marked Bibliotheca. Inside was a magnificent paneled library, heavy with Baroque, lined with wooden cases. Decorative cartouches above each defined its subject matter. Two massive tables stood on the checkerboard marble floor, their tops a puzzle of polished wood in remarkable patterns. The shelves were lined with illuminated medieval manuscripts, all safe within gilded leather cases, one after the other, thousands of them. The vault overhead was a sea of bright frescoes praising life and learning, the room illuminated by bright chandeliers. On the vaulting above, he noticed a painted phrase, "Sapientia edificavit sibi domum," "Wisdom hath built her house." He breathed in the rich aroma of aged leather and took some solace from the phrase. "Shall we sit?" Mirek said. They each slid out a wooden chair from one of the tables. "The time may have come to publicly discuss the protocol," he said to Mirek. "So much time has passed. It doesn't matter anymore." "But it does. We took an oath, and that means something to me. It should mean something to you. Remaining president of this country for another 5 years means more to me than any oath we took decades ago." His old friend gave him a puzzled look. So he explained what he was facing. "Do you ever think about those times?" Mirek asked when he finished. "When we changed the world." "I prefer to concentrate on the future. Part of that is keeping this country safe. American missiles will make us a prime target for Russia and Iran. I cannot allow that to happen. The United States wants to force me either to resign or to lose the coming election. If my people cannot contain that auction, the whole country will see me as a traitor. Only you and I will know different." "But Janusz, that was the whole idea. Secrecy is what made it all work. Nothing could have been accomplished otherwise." He knew this was going to be difficult, but he had to try. "Mirek, if the Americans acquire those SB documents, they will use them to force me to accept missiles inside our borders."
"Would you do such a thing?"
"I would be placed in an untenable position. If I resign, the Marshal of Parliament will become acting president, and he will definitely allow them to be placed here. If I refuse, they will expose me as some sort of traitor. I prefer better options than that."
The older man sat silent. He'd never been able to gauge this enigma's thinking. "During the Second World War, Polish resistance fighters met here, inside this library, to plot strategy," Mirek finally said. "They assumed they were safe in a monastery, and for the most part they were. Those brave men and women did a lot of damage. They disrupted German supply lines, provided military intelligence, and saved more Jews than any Allied government. All part of the great Polish underground state, which we inherited when we began the fight against the Soviets. We were the new Polish underground state.
And those sacrifices have not been forgotten. We celebrate them every September 27th, the day of the Polish underground state. The Nazis and the Soviets are gone, Mirek. The enemies today are much different. Many times they are your friends. The world has changed. I'll say it again. I need your help.
I want to show you something."
Mirek rose and approached the shelves, removing one of the tall leather cases, from which he freed an old tome. "This is the first volume of the Miraculorum Beatae Virginiae Monasterii Częstochowieses, a record of 498 miracles attributed to Our Lady from 1402 to 1642.
He was amazed. "They actually kept records." "Oh, yes. The Pauline monks were quite meticulous. They hand-wrote and documented each one of the miracles with facts about how it occurred, along with witnesses to the event. 2 handwritten and 5 printed registries still exist that inventory the miracles over a 400-year period. Whether those accounts are true is impossible to determine. All we know is that they exist. I assume there's a point to this. Mirek smiled. Definitely. I, too, have a record. He waited. Of the Warsaw Protocol. Chapter 44. Cotton stared at the big screen, which displayed an image of a handwritten document, the page filled with a heavy masculine script, all in Polish. At the bottom was a signature, a bit smeared but readable. Janusz Czakowski, along with a date, August 9th, 1982. As you can see, in the lower left corner is a seal, one used by the Służba Bezpieczeństwa from the 1970s until 1989 to certify its records. There are hundreds of thousands of these SB documents in existence with the same seal. Many are archived at the Institute of National Remembrance. The documents at issue today were kept by a former SB major, a man named Alexei Deletsky, who recruited a young Solidarity activist, Janusz Czakowski, as a government informant. You have a copy of this document in the stack of papers before you. Please take a closer look. Bunch was already reaching for the sheet. Do you read Polish? He asked Bunch. Hell no. If it's not English, it's not important to me. Why was he not surprised? Languages were easy for him, thanks to an eidetic memory he inherited from his father's side of the family. Unfortunately, Polish was not in his repertoire. For those of you not proficient, Olivier said, I have provided a translation in your native tongues on the next sheet. Cotton reached for that page ahead of Bunch. Together they read the English. Olivier pointed at the screen. This document states that Janusz Czakowski agrees to work as an informant and provide good and valuable information to the SB. You might ask, why was such a record created? Why not just keep everything informal? It was done to ensure the absolute loyalty of the informant. At the time, to be an informant was perhaps the worst thing a Pole could do. Releasing the signed document to the public would have been a way to disgrace the signer. Informants were terrified of being exposed, as there would be repercussions from both sides. So informants did what was expected of them, mostly as a way not to be exposed. Olivier paused. You can also see that Czakowski was given a code name to be used in the future. And not all that flattering, either. Baran. Sheep. Cotton studied the handwriting on the Polish copy. The signature has been authenticated, Olivier said. I employed 3 world-renowned experts who reviewed comparative material in the form of 142 documents that were either drafted or signed by Janusz Czakowski in the time frame from 1987 to last year. These included, among others, his former identity card, driver's license, proof of vehicle registration, documents from his time serving in Parliament, documents related to his purchase of land and a home, personnel files from 2 employers, pages stored in the office of the President of the Republic of Poland for the last 5 years, and passport files, all of which I obtain. The handwriting expert's findings will be provided to you. They all agree, with no reservation, that the documents at issue here are all in Czakowski's hand. And what if they are wrong? One of the French called out. And these are fakes. I assure you, I have no intention of selling fakes. Or a pig in a poke, as Mr. Bunch put it earlier. If any of them are deemed a forgery or fake within 14 days of this sale, I will return your money. After that, they are yours with no reservations. That should provide you plenty of time to authenticate. How much more of a guarantee do you want? But you will already have our money, one of the Iranians said. True. But all of you can hunt me down in a matter of hours. I recognize that fact, and have given it the respect it is due. Smart play, Cotton thought. Address the issue of credibility up front and acknowledge that the bidders were in a superior position. Everyone in the room seemed satisfied with both the concession and the condition. In the stack before you are more examples of the writings that will be for sale today. I will give you a few moments to study them. There is also an inventory sheet in your stack that provides an overview of all of what you will be buying. Cotton studied the list. One handwritten commitment to cooperate with the security service of 9 August 1982. 37 handwritten confirmation notes of receipt of money transferred by security service officers in return for information, all created between 12 August 1982 and 29 June 1989, totaling PLN 11,700. 49 handwritten reports of a secret collaborator, drawn up and signed with the codename Baran. 18 reports of a secret collaborator, not bearing the codename or any other signature, but definitely in the handwriting of Janusz Czakowski. 26 handwritten reports of a secret collaborator prepared by Janusz Czakowski, codenamed Baran, as outlined by the appointed security service officer, Alexei Dilecki. 5 handwritten reports consisting of 34 pages prepared by the appointed security service officer, Alexei Dilecki, bearing the codename Baran. 11 handwritten reports by the secret collaborator drawn up and signed with the codename Baran by the appointed security service officer, Alexei Dilecki. 147 pages. That was a lot for Czakowski to deny as a forgery. The sheer volume spoke to their authenticity, as did Olivier's confidence in his experts and his money-back guarantee, secured, of course, with his life. "I'm convinced," Bunch whispered. "Again, no surprise. To be labeled a former communist informant today in Polish society retains the same stigma as it once possessed, maybe even more so. But to be the president of the nation and have such a label stamped on you? That is unthinkable," Olivier said. "Look what happened to Lech Wałęsa. Documents surfaced showing he too may have been an informant. Handwriting experts verified their authenticity. Wałęsa declared the documents fake, created by the communists to discredit him. Eventually, a Polish court declared that he had not been a collaborator. But the stink would not go away. Finally, Wałęsa admitted to signing the documents, but said he was playing the SB, trying to learn what he could about them." Olivier shrugged. "What's the truth? Who knows? What we do know is that the taint remains. Here the situation is much clearer. Czakowski was one of millions who joined Solidarity in the 1980s. He was no Lech Wałęsa. He was a nobody. No one would have created any false documents to discredit him." "Unless they are a more recent forgery," one of the Chinese said. "Which will be an easy matter to expose. My experts tell me that the originals you will be buying are from the 1980s. The paper, the ink, everything is consistent. Czakowski's SB handler apparently kept many documents relative to various informants. Czakowski was just one of many. I personally viewed his cache." "He's still alive?" one of the Russians asked. "Long dead. But the information survived. There were 2 filing cabinets full of paper. One drawer was special. Documents on people who had achieved prominence since 1990. People whom the SB major had once been familiar with. He kept those files separate. One of those dealt with a young Solidarity activist named Janusz Czakowski, who went on to achieve great things." Olivier went silent, seemingly allowing his words to take hold. Bunch appeared thrilled at the prospects. Cotton remained concerned. Nothing about blackmail ever turned out good. Chapter 45. Tchaikovsky stared at his old friend. Had he heard right?
You have a record of the protocol.
I was mindful that one day history might need proof, after we are all gone.
Thank God for obsessive-compulsive behavior. It was what made Mirek such a superb intelligence officer, though he knew that his old friend hated the label. He'd much preferred Sova, which was what Lech Wałęsa had privately called him, while always adding a sly smile.
Are you still the owl? He asked. Mirek smiled and nodded. Solitary, nocturnal, with perfect vision, incredible hearing and sharp talents. But I'm not much of a hunter anymore for people's weaknesses. Thankfully, the people we dealt with back then had plenty to exploit. Where is your record of the Warsaw Protocol?
Safely hidden away.
Right now, as we speak, an auction is occurring where documents that are 100% authentic are being offered for sale to foreigners intent on using them to blackmail me. If that happens, I would then have two choices. Concede to their threats or be publicly ruined. I could even be tried for crimes against peace and humanity by the Commission for the Prosecution of Crimes Against the Polish Nation. What we did may certainly qualify, and I emphasize the we there. Many who we dealt with are still alive, men and women who would testify against us.
You're not the first who has come to me.
He was surprised.
Wałęsa came and asked the same thing you are asking to deal with his own troubles.
He was surprised.
Why would he do that?
It's simple, Mr. President. He was the one who tasked me with running the Warsaw Protocol. Mirek paused.
He was also its first participant.
Now he was shocked. The idea of the protocol had been simple. Turn SB's informants into counter-informants. Not all of them, of course, as there were far too many, but enough to cause havoc within the security services. A small cadre of men and women who routinely made reports to their handlers, except those reports were Mirek's creations. Some were innocuous, meaningless information that kept the informants in the SB's good graces. Some were deliberate lies, sending the SB off chasing ghosts with false leads, wasting time and resources. But eventually, the program traveled into darker territory. The imposition of martial law changed everything. Where before everyone had hoped that things were changing, that solidarity was making progress, the strong arm of the government eventually crushed all political opposition and sent the freedom movement underground. Thousands were arrested and jailed. People fled the country by the hundreds of thousands. The SB expanded its reach and worked hard to pit Poles against Poles. Spies were everywhere. So Mirek devised a way to deal with those spies. He used his army of counter-informants to turn the SB against their own. A perfect way to clear the opposition ranks. And it worked. Hundreds were arrested. People who thought themselves safe since they'd made a deal with the government to inform on their neighbors disappeared, never to be seen again. Most likely they were now rotting away in the ground somewhere, shot for their supposed duplicity. The communists were never tolerant of betrayal. The Warsaw Protocol allowed solidarity to continue to function without some of the prying eyes of the government. Was it 100% effective? Absolutely not. But it was effective enough to ensure that the movement survived. And Wałęsa himself created it?
What are you saying? He asked Mirek.
In the 1970s, Wałęsa was recruited as an informant. Of course, at the time, he was just a young electrician at the Gdańsk shipyard, a nobody. But he was tough and scrappy. He hated the communists and everything they had done to Poland. He wanted to know more about them. So he allowed himself to be recruited. It was quite an education, one he put to good use years later when he helped lead a revolt. When all of the furor arose over any supposed complicity, Wałęsa stayed silent for a while, but eventually stated that he was never an agent, never spied on anyone, took no money, and would prove it all in court. He also boldly stated that if he had to repeat his life, he would not change a thing. Now, Tchaikovsky knew why.
Valensa came here, Mirek said. We sat at this same table. He wanted me to testify before the court and prove his innocence. He knew of my record of the protocol and wanted it made public. I refused.
He took quite a public beating.
That's true. But he survived. As you will, too.
This is much different. He did not have to face an electorate. The safety of the Polish people was not at stake. Those missiles make us a target on Moscow's radar. They threaten our existence. We would have chosen sides in the conflict between East and West. My opponents will skewer me with those documents, if they are made public. Then the weak will bow down to the United States.
You have little faith in your government.
I have no faith. I believe only in me.
Mirek smiled. You always were the tough one. I saw that the first day we spoke, and you proved it every day thereafter. You were a fighter.
He appreciated the kind words.
I sympathize with your situation, Mirek said. I truly do. But it doesn't change things.
No. He supposed not.
I took Valensa's idea and expanded it from one person to hundreds, to eventually over 1,000. Not only did we learn about our enemy, we were able to mislead them, all made easy since they were too stupid and too anxious to be careful. In the process, yes, Poles were killed. But I have no regrets over those deaths. We had to weed out the traitors, and what better way to deal with them than allowing the government to kill its own? But what we did must remain secret. To reveal anything now would only taint what we accomplished.
I have no regrets either, he said. Those people chose their fate when they became spies against their neighbors.
That is exactly what Valensa said. I'll tell you the same thing I told him. I swore upon the Bible to God that I would take that secret to my grave. I kept a record only to clarify history, if that was ever needed after I was gone. What happened to Valensa, what's happening to you now, requires no clarification. This is not my problem.
He shoved the chair back and came to his feet. Anger surged through him.
Not your problem. You coerced me into your scheme, me and all of the others. We had no choice. Then I helped you recruit so many others. They and I worked for you so we could justify in our minds the weakness we'd shown to the SB.
His voice kept rising.
We convinced ourselves we were doing the right thing playing both sides. And we were, Mirek. It helped win the war. We took down a government. We threw the communists out. We gave courage to all of Eastern Europe to follow our lead. We changed the world.
The white-robed prelate never moved, his face set in stone. He allowed a moment for his words to take hold. Finally, Mirek said, in barely a whisper,
"That does not alter what we all agreed to. I can go public and expose it all," he pointed, "you included."
Mirek looked up at him.
"You can, but the taint upon you will still be there. So what? I'm destroyed at that point. There are others still alive who participated. They can speak out too. Not a one of whom would ever admit to being an informant, much less a counter-informant. None of those people want to relive any of that. Why would they? And if they do, it is merely their word. There is no proof. You will stand alone, Mr. President. Just as Valensa stood alone. Be strong, as he was.
If I do nothing, I will be ruined. Poland will be infested with foreign missiles, and if aggressions ever escalate, we'll be the first target Moscow will destroy. We'll be nothing but a puppet to the West, beholden to it for our safety, our existence.
History has shown that nobody gives a damn what happens to Poland, but I do.
You can draw comfort from the fact that you know the truth, that we did what was necessary and changed the world. In fact, what we did allows you to be in the position you are now in. It was glorious, Janusz. Glorious. He headed for the door. This had been a waste of time.
He turned back and faced Mirek, his expression cold, his eyes conveying the rage he felt.
That glory doesn't mean a thing anymore. It only counts within the mind of the pathetic coward who hides behind these walls.
And he left. Chapter 46.
Cotton now understood what all the furor was about. Somehow, Jaunty Olivier had managed to acquire 147 documents, most in President Janusz Czajkowski's own hand, that directly implicated the President of Poland as a former communist informant. He had to admit, it definitely looked bad.
"President Fox is going to love this," Bunch whispered. "It's everything he needs to make those missiles happen."
"And you think Poland is just going to roll over? Give you what you want without a fight? Get real, Malone. What can they do? If Czajkowski wants to stay president, he'll work with us. It's that simple."
No, it wasn't. Far from it, in fact. The Poles were a tough, resilient people who had survived both the Nazis and the Soviets. That was no small feat. They were now once again a free nation, and Cotton doubted they would relinquish that independence without a fight. Actually, he was counting on a fight. A part of him knew that his duty was to aid his country, but another part told him that his country was dead wrong.
"Are there any questions?" Olivier asked from the front of the gathering. "Will we have the documents today when we leave? You've insisted that payment has to be verified and completed immediately. When will we get what we paid for?" one of the French asked.
"The documents are not here. I have hidden them away in a place that is fairly inaccessible. I'm sure you can understand that precaution. I am the only one who knows that location. But again, all of you possess a vast multitude of resources, so obtaining them will be easy. I will inform my assistant, Vic DeGenti, of the location after the auction, and if you desire, he can be your guide. I'm hoping that gesture is a further demonstration of my good faith."
"And your distrust of us," one of the Russians added.
"What is there to trust?" Olivier said. "Each of you is here for different reasons, most of which conflict with the other. I realize that none of you are above using violence to get what you want. So no, I trust none of you, as I'm sure none of you trust me. This whole endeavor is not about trust. It's about power."
"It's about blackmail," Cotton said, "and coercion."
Olivier faced him.
"I suppose it is. A most unpleasant business."
"But profitable," he said, adding a smile.
"That it is. Or at least, I'm hoping so."
Olivier extended his arms in a welcome embrace. Everyone looked back in silent anticipation.
"Shall we begin?"
Czajkowski rode in the back of the car driven by his two security people, still unnerved by the meeting with his former boss. Mirek had always been a hard man, difficult to know, even harder to like. But the nature of the job had demanded a certain degree of detachment. Of all the recruits, only a few managed to get close. He'd always thought himself one of those. How many counter-informants had he personally recruited for Mirek? 50? More like 100. People who'd placed their lives on the line. Some even gave their lives. Others had them taken. Which would all come out if the protocol became public, the good and the bad. How would the people react? Would he face charges? Had what he'd done been a crime against peace and humanity? Hard to say. And that indecision troubled him. His cell phone vibrated. He found the unit and saw it was Sonia.
"I hope you have good news," he said, answering. "The tracker worked," she said. "The auction is occurring at Sterny Castle inside Slovakia. Not that far away."
No, it wasn't.
Where are you?
Positioned about half a kilometer away among the trees. I've watched as three cars drove inside, all similar to the cars that brought Cotton and Bunch.
You still think Malone knew you would be following?
Absolutely. You have to think that whoever transported Malone and Bunch to the castle guarded against being followed. Yet Cotton made sure that tracker stayed active. I was able to stay a long way back. Now I just have to figure out how to get inside undetected.
What do you plan to do once there?
Improvise. Be careful.
You sound like you care.
I do.
He heard the smile in her voice.
Which is wonderful to hear.
I'll check back when I have something to report. The call ended. He considered having Miroslav Father Mirek Hachia arrested and a full-scale search instituted for his so-called proof. Maybe tie him naked over a stool. He hated himself for even thinking such a thing. Was that desperation? What else could it be? It drove the communists, but it would never motivate him. He was the duly elected president of the Republic of Poland, entrusted with looking after the welfare of the nation. His job was to make smart, informed decisions that advanced the greater good. Only this was personal. No other way to view it, since everything was being directed his way.
Do you wish to go to the airport? One of the security men asked. They were headed south back toward Kraków and would pass the airport on the way. But he could not return to Warsaw.
Not yet.
No. To the hotel, please.
Chapter 47.
Eli Reinhardt stood just inside the open bedroom door, listening to what was happening past the second floor railing down in the great hall. It seemed everything was about to begin. He turned to Munoz. Are you ready? His associate nodded and walked over to the bed. A black Louis Vuitton duffel bag lay on the woven spread. They'd brought it with them when they arrived last night at the castle. Jonty had been overly accommodating and not searched anything. Eli had been counting on a drop in guard, hoping Olivier would be trying as hard as he could not to antagonize anyone. That was why he'd made such an inviting offer to seal their partnership, conceding away half of the hidden cash and defraying any financial interest in the auction, save for a relatively small cash payment. Of course, 20 million euros was not necessarily small, but he had to display some semblance of opportunism. Otherwise, Jonty definitely would have become suspicious. Now, here he was, exactly where he wanted to be. He listened as Jonty called for the first round of bids. He heard 50 million euros, then 60, 70.
We need to deal with Mr. DiGenti, he said to Art, while things progress below.
Munoz reached into the duffel bag and removed two Uzis with extended 40-round clips. An old-school weapon, but proven and reliable. He laid them on the bed, then found two pistols with sound suppressors attached to their short barrels inside the bag. Eli grabbed one of the pillows and handed it to Munoz. They slipped from the room, staying close to the inner wall, the second-floor railing 3 meters away. No way they could be seen from below. They left the gallery and found a corridor at one end that led deeper into the castle. DiGenti was holed up in one of the second-floor bedrooms in a makeshift command post, monitoring the closed-circuit cameras that watched the main gate and other points beyond the walls, waiting for the auction to conclude. The jammer was located there too, which cut off all communications in and out. A single laptop was the exception, hot-wired to a direct internet line to be used shortly to verify the high bid and transfer funds. Jonty had seemed quite proud of all the preparations when he'd shown them off earlier. They approached the closed door. He signaled for Art to position himself to one side while he grabbed the knob. His minion gripped the gun, nestling the suppressor's end into the pillow. What was about to happen would be irrevocable. No turning back. But he'd known that would be the case when he agreed to all of this in the first place. He gripped the knob and slowly turned, pushing the heavy panel inward.
DeGenti reacted to the intrusion by springing to his feet, where he sat before video monitors, and turning toward the door, reaching for a weapon in a shoulder holster. Art never hesitated, firing the 9mm twice and sending the thin, wiry man to the floor. They entered, and Eli closed the door. Art fired one last time through the pillow, planting a third round into DeGenti's skull. Little sound had escaped. Perfect. He approached the monitors and studied the images, each a different swath of the outer walls and the road into the castle. Leaves on the birches and oaks hung motionless in the midday sun. DeGenti was all Jaunty had for protection inside the castle. The staff had left just before the auction began, as had all the chauffeurs. No chance for any prying eyes or ears to see or hear anything. A wise precaution, but it also provided the perfect opportunity. He found the signal jammer and switched it off. Then he sent a text message out over his phone that all was clear. One more thing. He stepped over and searched to Genty's pockets, hoping. Jaunty had told the participants that his man would be available to lead the winner to the prize, saying that his associate was not yet aware of the information's location. That had to be a lie. Jaunty would never have done that all by himself. Perhaps there was some written record of that location, and in the front pocket he found a folded sheet of paper. On it was written, 9 Bobola. Was this it? Could be. He pocketed the paper. Let's return to the auction and see where it goes, he said, his voice low. And finish this. Cotton was impressed. The latest bid was 120 million euros from the Iranians. The French and the Chinese seemed to have hit their limit, as they'd not upped the ante once it topped 100 million. The North Koreans also were beginning to go silent. It seemed to be a battle between Russia, Iran, and the United States, the three with the most skin in the game. 150 million, Bunch said in a firm, decisive voice. Quite a jump. 30 million euros in one swipe.
160, the Russians bid.
Olivier was directing traffic in a calm, collected manner, keeping things moving, not allowing a lot of time for the participants to hesitate. He could at any moment bring things to a close, and none of the three still in the game would want that to happen. Not unless, of course, one of them was the high bidder.
175, the Iranians said. 200 million, the Russians countered.
250, Bunch called out.
A quarter of a billion euros. Cotton wondered if any piece of information was worth that much. But apparently so.
You do realize, one of the Russians said, that we have lots of money, too.
Then spend it, Bunch said. 250 million euros is America's bid.
300, the Russian said, his face defiant.
350, Bunch countered.
400,
the North Koreans said, which momentarily jarred the room. Cotton wondered where the Democratic People's Republic of Korea would get nearly half a billion euros. That was a substantial sum for anyone. No one countered.
What's the problem? He whispered to Bunch.
It's getting out of hand.
You think?
450 million, the Russian said in a calm voice.
Something was wrong. The bidding was progressing in unusual leaps. No one was interested in inching the price upward. Instead, they all seemed intent on preempting the others with outrageous numbers. He stared at the participants, hoping to transmit some of his own suspicions to them.
500 million,
Bunch said. Silence reigned. The two Russians stood from their chairs.
We are done. Have a car brought for us.
I must conclude this auction first, Olivier said. This auction is over for us.
What's the matter? Bunch said. Sore loser.
The taller of the two Russians glared at Bunch, then said,
Mr. Malone, you met a man in Bruges. Did he not tell you what our intent would be?
We not know where auction will occur, but when we do, we will act. Tell Stephanie Nell that I do not bluff. Ivan's words, right before he fired the taser.
That intent has not changed, the Russian said.
Cotton caught another pinprick of trouble in the man's cutting black eyes, a spark that flared a warning.
Not good. We wait outside.
The two Russians marched from the hall.
Are there any more bids? Olivier asked.
No one replied.
Last chance.
More silence.
Then I declare the United States the winner.
Hot damn, Malone, Bunch said. We did it.
But what exactly had they done?
Eli had listened to the entire proceeding. Half a billion euros. Jonty must be ecstatic.
There was talk coming from below as the auction wound down. He glanced out the doorway and saw the two Russian bidders who'd exited the hall appear at the top of the staircase. He motioned for them to wait there, out of sight. He and Munoz lifted an Uzi from the bed, then fled the room, staying away from the railing and easing toward the staircase, where they handed over the weapons. The two Russians then stepped across the second-floor gallery to the balustrade and opened fire.
Chapter 48.
Tchaikovsky re-entered the Sheraton Grand Krakow through a back door that the hotel had made available for his exclusive use. Two of the hotel's security men staffed the entrance and opened the metal door for him as he approached. He was taking a huge chance lingering. His ruling coalition teetered on collapse almost every day, one faction or another always demanding something. His job was to keep them all happy, and his chief of staff had already told him the people were asking questions. His answer was that he was working on the next election, cementing what would be needed to carry Kraków and Małopolskie province, which was not far from the truth. That should hold them off for another day, which was all he needed. This would be over, one way or another, soon. He took an elevator up and walked back to the Royal Vavel suite, his two BOR security men in tow. Once inside, he'd have privacy, which he'd need if Sonya called. His watch read nearly 1 p.m., and he wondered what was happening at that auction. Frightening that his entire future was being decided by strangers trying to outbid one another for the chance to destroy him. He flushed all that negativity from his mind, re-entered the suite, found his phone, and called Sonya.
"I only have a moment," she said. "I'm inside the castle."
"What's happening?"
"Trouble. A car arrived a few moments ago. I could not see who it was, but I followed it in on foot."
"Have you seen the auction?"
"Not yet, but I'm going to find it now."
He heard rat-tat-tat through the phone. Then more.
"Is that gunfire?" he asked.
"I have to go."
Jonty's emotions went from a mountainous high of 500 million euros and how his life was about to irrevocably change, to the horrifying fear that his life could be over.
Gunshots. From the upper gallery.
A deafening volley raked the hall. He looked up and saw the two Russian bidders who'd left firing automatic weapons below. The people remaining in the great hall reacted to the attack and sprang from their seats, scattering, but with no cover. They were simply cut down, one after another. The bodies of both Chinese erupted in splattering wounds, their muscles contorting in a drunken dance that ended with them smashing face down to the stone floor. A similar fate met the French and Iranians. Jonty stood, frozen with indecision, a nauseous feeling of panic surging toward his throat. Running seemed stupid, but he should do something. Fright welled in his throat and forced his breath to come in choppy gasps. He dropped behind the big screen TV and its wooden support, seeking cover. Cotton reacted with reflexes that had been trained and conditioned long ago, springing from the chair and reaching for Tom Bunch. They were totally exposed in the center of the hall, at least 50 feet between here and where they'd be beyond the shooter's angle above. He yanked Bunch toward the right side of the hall, beneath the upper gallery. But Bunch resisted and pulled away.
"Olivier, we have to get to him."
Two new sounds entered the hall. Gunshots from a different weapon. A pistol, which momentarily stopped the Uzis. His head whipped to the right and he saw Sonya rush into the hall, firing upward. He took advantage of the moment she'd bought him and lunged left, through an arch beneath the overhead gallery, out of the line of fire.
The gunmen above resumed their attack, cutting down three more of the auction participants. Bunch foolishly moved toward Olivier, who was nowhere to be seen. Above, Cotton caught sight of the two gunmen at the railing, their weapons aimed downward. The two Russian bidders. "Halt!" one of them yelled out. Bunch froze. He heard clips being ejected and fresh ones inserted. Everyone else who'd been part of the auction lay dead in ever-growing pools of blood. Only he and Bunch were unharmed, along with jaunty Olivier, whom he now saw was crouched behind the TV. Sonya was across the hall, with no shot upward as the gunmen were directly above her. One of the Russians above let him know they were watching by unleashing a short barrage of rounds that obliterated the stone supporting the arch he was using for cover. He managed to steal a quick peek around the edge and saw the older man from earlier staring down at him, another younger man standing beside him. Both gripped pistols. He also noticed that Sonya was no longer on the far side, most likely headed up to deal with the problem. So stall them. "Could you explain the point of all this?" he called out.
"The point's obvious," a new voice said from above, with a Russian accent, one he recognized.
Cotton glanced up to see a new face standing at the railing. Ivan, who'd apparently found a way here too.
"You were warned, Malone. Clear. Emphatic."
"We don't take orders from Moscow," Bunch yelled. "Not now. Not ever." "Shut up, Tom," Cotton said, hoping the use of the first name would strike home. He needed to buy Sonya more time, so he said, "Okay, Ivan, I get it. Point made. What now?"
"That depends on Olivier."
Cotton shifted positions to the other side of the pillar so he could see Olivier and Bunch more clearly. They both stood near the large screen TV, their heads cocked upward. Concern filled Bunch's face.
"I should have known better," Olivier said. "You're no good."
"I rather think my performance was masterful," the older man holding the pistol said.
"What do you want, Eli?" Olivier said.
"I have what I want." That didn't sound good.
"You had your people run the press up during the auction, didn't you?" Cotton asked, interrupting, calling out to Ivan. "Since you knew they were all going to die, why not bid hundreds of millions of euros?"
"Americans think money solves everything," Ivan said.
He caught Bunch's gaze with his own and motioned for him to stay quiet.
"Your president told Kremlin that you would not even be here," Ivan said. "All lies."
"It was necessary," Bunch said, "to deal with you."
One of the Uzis erupted in a brief rattle of fire. Bunch's body jolted from the impact of the rounds, his face frozen in shock, his arms flailing, trying to maintain balance. Then he collapsed to the floor, dead.
"That necessary too," Ivan said.
Cotton shook his head. "Damn it."
Chapter 49 Eli stared down into the great hall. Odd how thinking like a villain both worried and stimulated him. He faced the Russian named Ivan. His benefactor was short, heavy-chested, with grayish-black hair. He wore an ill-fitting suit that bulged at the waist. The deal had been to not only smuggle in the weapons, but also lead the Russians to the site. That had been accomplished yesterday when Ivan had tracked the car he and Munoz had used to get to the castle. Again, jaunty had been far too accommodating. Then, once Degenti had been eliminated, a text told Ivan the coast was clear for him to arrive.
"Malone, my friend," Ivan called out. "We must talk."
The American remained hidden behind the arch.
"You waiting for Sonya to act?" Ivan asked.
No reply.
"Sonya," Ivan called out. "Sonya!"
More silence.
"Come out," Ivan said. "We must talk too. You're not supposed to be here, and you know that."
Cotton heard Ivan's words. "Not supposed to be here." What was Sonya doing? He looked around the stone arch. Five hostile faces stared down at him with silent menace. He glanced at jaunty Olivier, who again crouched behind the big screen TV, near Bunch's body.
You killed the Deputy National Security Advisor of the United States, Cotton called out.
Who not be missed, Ivan said. We have many deputies in Russia, many more who want job. I'm sure you do too.
It will not go unanswered. Ivan laughed.
Your new president not so tough. He thinks himself tough, but he just a liar. Unlike him, you know us, Malone. You would have listened and stayed away. I have no problem with you.
What had he gotten himself into? Obviously, the Russians had been serious back in Bruges, but the carnage around him seemed a bit much even for them. So much risk, taken against people who had the means and resources to retaliate. And would. He was bare-assed to the wind, and there was little he could do. 5 men stood in the gallery above him, 2 armed with Uzis, 2 with pistols. Stinking cordite filled the air, along with the coppery waft of blood.
Come out, Jonty, the older man named Eli said. There's no need to hide. If we wanted you dead, you would be already.
Who are you? Cotton asked.
My name is Augustus Eli Reinhardt V. I am an acquaintance of Jonty's, so I doubt he'd claim me any longer.
Olivier slowly revealed himself. Are you working with the Russians? Cotton asked Reinhardt.
Of course he is, Ivan answered. We stay in front of this from the start. He'll lead us straight here.
You'll never find those documents, Olivier blurted out. They are hidden away. I'm the only one who knows where they are.
I would not underestimate me again, Reinhardt said.
The comment came quick, and Cotton read something in the older man's tone. Confidence, like a man who knew something. His warning senses cautioned that Reinhardt could represent the greatest threat, even over Ivan. Olivier was surely hoping that what he knew would keep him alive, and perhaps it might. But Olivier was clearly worried, as the pudgy man's hands shook and a vein on his right temple squirmed with each beat of the heart, like a fat blue worm. He was probably trying to assess things, too. But nothing about this situation made sense. 2 plus 2 here added up to 900, especially considering the wild card. Where was Sonya? Jonty had never experienced the seething conflict of emotions that rushed through him, an unsettling combination of a burgeoning excitement, a chilly dread, and irrational anger. The extent of the horror that surrounded him was beyond words. Never had he imagined such an outcome. His business was hardly ever violent. But this was clearly a different scenario. Thankfully, his hatred of Eli Reinhardt transcended his fear and brought him strength. Where is Vic? He asked.
Dead, Eli said. You're on your own, Jonty.
There was no need to do this. None at all.
So you would have turned everything over? Eli asked. Just like that. All I had to do was ask.
This was my deal. But you couldn't leave it alone. What was the pantry? A diversion. Just a way for you to get close.
Exactly. And it worked. You were so accommodating. But this is business, Jonty. Nothing more. Though I will say for my associate here, Mr. Munoz, it's a bit more personal. He truly wants to kill you.
Jonty could see that was the case. The Bulgarian's weapon was trained straight at him.
Sadly for him, Eli said, he can't. That was not part of the deal.
Which begged the question. What was? Eli watched his adversary stand firm. Impressive, considering Olivier's dire predicament. The Russians had simply asked that they be led to this location and that weapons be provided, so all of the participants could be killed, save for Jonty. He'd not questioned that condition since he was being paid an obscene amount of money. Then fate had smiled upon him and provided the folded piece of paper in his pocket. Was it the key to where the damaging information was hidden? He intended on finding out just as soon as he was away from the castle. Truth be told, Russians made him nervous. Slavs in general made him nervous. They were an unpredictable lot, whose motivations were most times impossible to decipher. Overall, they were well-educated and well-read. They loved theater, opera, concerts, and ballet. He'd learned long ago that the power of an individual was not nearly as important as family, friends, and acquaintances. You had to know people to get things done, which was why Russians had lots of friends. What was happening here seemed proof positive of that maxim. Know the right people. You could arrange almost anything. Like crashing a secret auction and killing everyone there. But Russians were difficult. Many elements of their character he found unsavory. They had few principles, rejected tradition, and were overly cynical. Flashy, too. Gender still meant something there, the roles of men and women clearly defined. Overall, they were a blunt, serious people, chain smokers and habitual drinkers, superstitious to the point of annoyance. But he was an accessory to mass murder, so who was he to judge? He'd hated dealing with them, but had out of necessity, since Moscow's money was as good as everyone else's. But none of that answered the most important question. What now? Cotton had been in some tight spots, but this one ranked near the top of the list. He was trapped in the lower arcade, across the great hall, 50 feet away and 10 feet up in the opposite upper gallery. Trouble stared down. Apparently, Olivier had been kept alive purposefully, and he'd managed to dodge the bullets.
"I want to know," Ivan said, pointing at Olivier. "Are you truly the only one who knows where information is kept?"
"Only me and my associate, who is now dead." Olivier's tone had returned to businesslike. "I'm the only route left to it. Kill me, and it's gone." Which surely explained why Olivier was still breathing. Cotton watched as Reinhardt considered that information, too. Pitting him against Ivan seemed like the smart play. But he was interrupted when the doors banged open, and Sonya re-entered the hall. Chapter 50 Tchaikovsky stared out the window at Vavel Castle. He was nursing his second whiskey, propped in the bed, the same one he and Sonya had shared last night. The last thing he'd heard was gunshots through the phone. What was happening? Was Sonya all right? Her reputation was legendary, and her superiors spoke of her in glowing terms. But that didn't mean trouble could not find her. He savored another sip, allowing the alcohol to trickle down his throat and burn away the anxiety. Out the window, the view to the castle was across a busy street, up a rocky slope populated with cafes and restaurants. Crowds occupied the path that encircled Vavel Hill, particularly off to the right at the exit for the Dragon's Den, where an enormous bronze effigy of the famous dragon stood atop a limestone boulder. Seven-headed, with one that breathed fire thanks to an ingeniously placed natural gas nozzle. It had even been modernized so that a text message from a phone could trigger the fire, which people did hundreds of times each day. Modern technology. The bane of his existence. The entire reason he was in this mess. The Aegis Ballistic Missile Defense System. Designed to provide protection against short to intermediate range ballistic missiles and to intercept incoming missiles above the atmosphere prior to re-entry, long before they could do any damage, with a fragmentation warhead. Right now, they were deployed on U.S. warships and land-based in Japan and Romania. But were they reliable? Nobody knew. Most times they worked, but most was not all. Russia hated them, saying they were merely fueling a new arms race based on non-existent dangers, since Iran had never threatened Europe with missiles. The last time the idea was proposed, Russia announced that it would deploy short-range nuclear missiles along its NATO borders. A new Cold War had been predicted. Putin even stated that Russia would withdraw from the Nuclear Forces Treaty of 1987, and that the chance of Poland being subject to attack in the event of war was 100%. He had no reason to think that this time would be any different. Nearly 60% of Poles had been opposed to the missiles. He imagined that percentage would be higher this time. So far, the outcry had been minimal, but the debate had not yet begun. Oddly, years ago, the Polish government's response to the first cancellation of the program had been mixed. Some had been glad the missiles were gone, but a sizable block voiced concern that the country would lose its special status in Washington, that Obama had canceled the project to appease Moscow at Poland's expense. One proposal in Parliament had been to spend the equivalent of $10 billion in zlotys to build their own missile defense system. Talk about insane. He recalled one party leader lamenting that the decision to withdraw the initiative had been made independent of Polish sensitivities. Lech Wałęsa had been openly critical of the cancellation, saying, "Americans have always only taken care of their own interests, and they have used everyone else." One front-page headline he recalled quite clearly. "Ale byliśmy naiwni. Zdrada. USA sprzedały nas Rosji. Wbiły nam nóż w plecy." We were so naive. Betrayal. The U.S. sold us to Russia and stabbed us in the back. Oddly, the ending announcement came on September 17, 2009, a date of great symbolic value, as it had been on September 17, 1939, that the Soviet Union invaded Poland. Irony? A message? Or just a coincidence? Who knew? Ever since the announcement by President Fox, the Foreign Ministry had been working on both responses and alternatives, ways to try to appease both sides. No formal request for the missile base had yet been made. He assumed Fox was waiting to acquire the ammunition he would need to make sure that there was no meaningful opposition from Warsaw. And certainly the Americans knew they had a friendly ear with the Marshal of Parliament, who would temporarily assume the presidency if a resignation was forced. That's when things would escalate out of control into a wild national debate. He needed to handle this. One man, quick and decisive. Thankfully, the Constitution gave him the power, which could not be overruled. Why had Sonia not called back? He wanted to call her, but knew better. He had to trust her to handle it. He finished his drink, and knew better than to have another. The door to the outer room opened. He stood and stepped from the bedroom. Michał Zima occupied the entranceway. Odd. He wondered why this cold, calculating man had traveled south from Warsaw.
"I've come to see if I can help," Zima said.
"With what?"
"Szczerny Castle."
Apparently the head of the BOR had become well informed.
"What do you know about that?"
"I know that a Russian foreign intelligence operative named Ivan is there. He was detected in Bruges, where he came into contact with a former American agent named Cotton Malone. Interestingly, Malone was here yesterday in Krakow, where four of the AW's intelligence agents brought him to you."
"You've been busy."
"I've been doing my job."
He appraised Zima with a critical eye.
"You've been doing exactly what I told you not to do. I'm not your enemy. But you're not my friend either. I am here to protect the president of this country. Being your friend was never part of that duty. But if you must know, I actually admire your leadership."
That was a surprise, and welcomed.
"Something is happening that affects the security of this nation," Zima said. "Something that involves our foreign intelligence agency. I'm aware of your relationship with Sonia Draga. The BOR has accommodated your requests in that area. Again, I am not here to judge, only to help."
"Michał, I appreciate your concern and your offer, but I cannot involve the BOR. This is a personal matter."
"That somehow concerns a man who once directed the secret intelligence services for Solidarity."
Zima surely knew of the trip to Jasna Góra, since two of his men had been there, but he was surprised about the reference to Mirek Hatchia's past life experience.
"Is that a well-known fact?" he asked.
"To some it is, but it's a select few. Does whatever is happening here relate to what happened back in the 1980s?
He decided to be honest.
"It does.
And Major Delitzky was likewise involved. I could tell when we were at his house that you knew the man. I can only assume that since he retained records on others,
he did so on you. Records that are now out in the open.
That would be a safe assumption.
And Sterne Castle is where they have surfaced.
In a manner of speaking, they are being auctioned to the highest bidder.
He caught the moment of concern on Jima's face. Perhaps this man did genuinely care.
Sonia is there, he said, trying to stop that from happening.
But there were gunshots during her last call to me.
I'm concerned.
The door leading out of the suite opened. Usually the security detail knocked first before allowing an intrusion. Then he caught sight of his visitor and understood. His wife, who did not look happy.
Chapter 51.
Cotton kept his eyes locked on Sonia as she crouched near another of the arches, 30 feet away.
There she is, Ivan called out. You're not supposed to be here.
And yet I am, she said.
The Russian laughed, a rumbling, indolent guffaw, half real, half forced, and totally unfriendly. Now he got it. She was disarming these people, creating confusion, doing what she did best, playing them.
Who are you? Jaunty Olivier asked Sonia.
The one who brings you greetings from the President of the Republic of Poland. Did you really think we would just let this auction happen?
Olivier said nothing.
What now? Cotton asked them all. As Olivier says, Ivan noted, only he knows where information is hidden. We need him to tell us.
Not going to happen, Olivier declared.
Forget about the Americans for a moment, Cotton said. Do any of you think the Chinese, the North Koreans, the French, the Iranians are not going to retaliate?
Maybe you a good person to blame, Ivan said. Former spy. Here. Your reputation will work against you. Of course, you will try and convince all that you did nothing. Then we could blame Poles. They would certainly want all this stopped. Like I say, Sonia, you're not supposed to be here.
There are a lot of witnesses here, Cotton pointed out.
Good point, Ivan said.
The big man reached beneath his jacket, removed a pistol, then turned and shot both of the other two Russians with Uzis in the head. Cotton had witnessed all kinds of depravity and transgressions, his job usually to exploit those sins to his advantage, but he was appalled by the killing. Death occurred in his profession, no question. He'd pulled the trigger himself more than once in the heat of battle. But this was different. Compulsion seemed to be replacing reason. Protest burned his throat, but he knew better than to say a word. He glanced across the hall at Sonia, then turned his attention back to the second floor.
Just you left, Malone, Ivan said. And you, Sonia. But there was one other loose end, and it was standing a few feet away.
He had little sympathy for Jaunty Olivier. The man had tried to pet 6 rattlesnakes simultaneously. What had he expected? That they would lie docile and like it? No surprise that one had reared up and bit him. The Fox administration had been fools to try to manipulate this scenario. On what planet would the deployment of medium-range missiles only a few hundred miles from the Russian border not be met with a show of force? Bunch and Fox thought that lies and deception would work. Maybe in the business world. But this was the big leagues, where you played for keeps. You just didn't lose a deal or some money. You lost your life. The participants here had played the game for a long time. Warner Fox was a rookie, and an arrogant one at that. Tom Bunch had been a blind follower, intent only on pleasing his boss, ignorant to the risks he'd taken. Now he was lying in a pool of his own blood in a remote Slovakian castle. He studied both Sonia and Ivan, trying to decide what was next. The best he could determine was that their interests diverged. Ivan would want the information Olivier had to sell as insurance against the Poles. It could provide an effective way to keep American missiles out of Poland, and a means of control over a foreign head of state. Russian interrogation techniques would be more than enough to break Jaunty Olivier. The man would eventually tell them anything and everything he knew. Sonia would want the information destroyed, so it could never be used again.
It was essentially destroyed now, hidden away where only one person knew its location. Olivier would surely have chosen a spot that would remain secret. Could it resurface? Possible, but not likely. Or at least not likely within the relevant time frame of the next 5 years of Joukovsky's second term as president. After that, whatever Olivier had to peddle would be worthless. "You seem to have a problem," he told Ivan. The big Russian shrugged.
"I do my job. But Sonya not supposed to be here. Olivier is mine."
"I'm not telling any of you anything," Olivier blurted out.
Sonya stayed behind the arch, but raised her weapon and pointed it at Olivier.
"Where is the spear of Morris?"
"Now that I can tell you. It's in a car, just beyond the courtyard, with the other relics, awaiting my departure." She lowered her gun.
"I came for that. That's why I'm here."
Made sense. A national treasure had to be returned, especially one that she'd allowed to be stolen. Ivan shrugged.
"You now have. Go."
Two shots tore the air and echoed through the hall. His head whipped to the right. Sonya had fired, but not upward. He looked left. Olivier stared in astonishment at the spreading red stain across his shirt that clutching fingers could not contain. Air gasped from his mouth, followed by more blood. Then the eyes rolled skyward, and the stout body thumped hard to the floor.
"No, this is over," Sonya called out. "There will be no missiles, and nobody gets that information. It stays wherever it is."
He stared at her.
"The Polish government had unfinished business with Jonty Olivier," she said. "That matter is now resolved."
"Not good," Ivan said. "This is a problem."
"Let it go," she called out. "That may not be possible. I wanted Olivier alive."
"Cotton."
He turned toward Sonya. She slid a gun across the polished stone floor straight to him. He grabbed the weapon, checked the magazine, then chambered around. "Ready."
"There's two of us now," he told Ivan. "You can walk out of here, or be carried out with a bullet in you. Take your pick."
Silence reigned. He risked a look and saw that the three men above him were looking at one another, Reinhardt surely waiting for Ivan to make a decision.
"I didn't come here to die," Reinhardt finally made clear.
"All right," Ivan said. "We be done."
He watched as the three men withdrew from the railing and began to leave the second floor. He'd need to stay alert until they were gone from the building. He turned back toward where Sonya had been hidden. But she was gone.
Chapter 52. Joukovsky felt the tension that entered the hotel room with his wife. He'd married her 21 years ago when they were both much younger and far less political. They'd since led public lives, and for a time they'd been a team. Not anymore. They were now two separate entities, intertwined only by ambition. "Please excuse us," he said to Zhima. The head of the BOR nodded and left the suite.
"Make sure we're not disturbed," his wife added.
This was not going to be good.
"Why are you here, Anna?"
"That was going to be my first question to you."
He wondered how much she knew. Or was this a fishing expedition? She settled herself onto the sofa. She'd dressed for the occasion in an expensive Chanel suit, pearl gray, little jewelry, low heels. Perfect for the first lady of the nation.
"I'm told you've been here 2 days, after canceling appointments and clearing your schedule. Then I'm told your girlfriend stayed here last night."
No surprise she would know any of that. She had a BOR security detail, too, and those agents surely talked to one another.
"I want to know what's going on," she said.
"I'm dealing with the coming election."
She laughed.
"And I'm the Virgin Mary. Come now, Janusz. I came for answers."
She paused.
"Truthful answers. Something unusual is happening."
"What makes you say that?"
"I know you."
Which was a problem. Hard to fool somebody who's been there nearly half your life. So he decided not to even try.
"The Warsaw Protocol has come back to haunt us."
He'd told her the truth a long time ago, back when they were more like husband and wife.
That sorry excuse for a human being, Dilitsky, kept documents on me. How? Why? I have no idea. I only know that he did, and they still exist. And your girlfriend is trying to retrieve them.
He nodded.
An effort is being made. How wonderful that you have her in this time of need.
He caught the sarcasm and wondered about jealousy. That emotion had long left them both, part of their arrangement.
This has international implications, he said. The security of this nation is at risk. If a foreign government obtains that information, it could be used against me. I may be forced to resign, or worse, do what they want. I don't want to do either of those.
She appraised him with a gaze he knew all too well.
It's that bad.
He nodded.
You know what I did back then. You know what we all did.
I know what you told me.
He was shocked at her reservations.
Am I to understand that you think I was an informant for the communists? That I sold out my fellow citizens? That I took their filthy money to help them keep us under their thumb? Do you really believe that?
Her pale blue eyes cast one of her trademark stares.
You and I both know what you did, Janusz. How many died?
He'd thought about the past a lot lately.
46. Excuse me?
That's how many of my recruits I know were killed. She sat up.
Now that's new information. All these years, and you never mentioned how many actually paid the price.
All were men and women who willingly took money from the SB in return for willingly providing information on their family, friends, neighbors, and acquaintances to the security service. The worst possible traitors. No one forced them to do a thing. No one coerced them. They had not been beaten or forced to crawl across a prison floor. So what he and a few others had done was easy. Find active recruits of the SB who were not working willingly, who had been forced to spy, then turn them into double agents and feed the government controlled information, just enough of a spark of truth to keep the informants out of trouble, and the SB busy chasing shadows. And it worked. Big time. Eventually, they took it to the next level. Feeding more strategic and damaging information, designed to totally discredit some of those willing informants and make the SB question their loyalty. Enough that, in some cases, the SB permanently eliminated those informants. 46 that he knew about. Every one of those people deserved their fates, he said. They sold us all out for greed. I don't regret a single one of those deaths.